Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Weissman, editor of Multinational Monitor, who assesses the major issues for the U.S. economy linked to the fate of the American auto industry. Hagit Ofran of the Israeli group Peace Now, who talks about the recent clashes between the Israeli army and Jewish settlers in the Palestinian city of Hebron. And Christopher Anders, senior legislative counsel with the ACLU, who explains why abolition of government-authorized torture must be a top priority for President-elect Barack Obama. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Since Somalia pirates seized a shipment of Russian tanks, supposedly destined for the rebel-controlled semi-autonomous government in southern Sudan, the Sudanese government in Khartoum seized a cargo plane carrying light arms and ammunition in Juba, the capital of southern Sudan. Sudan has recalled its ambassadors from Kenya and Ethiopia because the Sudanese believe these nations were selling arms to the semi-autonomous rebel government. Sudan and the rebels have many unresolved issues, including unsettled borders, a conflict over oil revenues, and a planned referendum over the future status of southern Sudan. The two governments have maintained an uneasy peace for 3 years. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the semi-autonomous regime, controlled by the Sudan People's Liberation Army, or SPLA, has bought tanks, armored personnel carriers, assault rifles, and rocket-propelled grenades from Ethiopia, Kenya, South Africa, and the United States. The government in Khartoum has purchased weapons from Eastern Europe and China. One Western diplomat observed, "The SPLA has 170,000 armed men. That's larger than any army in Africa, and there's been no appreciable disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration in Sudan." In the face of a global economic recession, China is facing a massive wave of factory closures and bankruptcies of companies who export goods to Western nations. In recent weeks, Tao Shulong, owner of one of China's biggest textile dye operations, abandoned his empire, leaving behind 4 factories, 4,000 workers, and a debt of over $200 million. According to the Los Angeles Times, over 3,600 toy factories have shut down in recent months. Many of the migrant workers who toiled in factory complexes do not qualify for unemployment benefits and are returning to rural areas. Economic growth in China is expected to fall by 2/3 by the end of the year. To combat the increase in unemployment, Beijing has announced a $600 billion stimulus package to boost the Chinese economy. For the first time in 3 years, production of electricity is declining, and falling commodity prices are hurting exports. Many huge steel mills have already fallen silent. In early December, Canada's Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper convinced Canadian Governor General Michel Jean to suspend Parliament until January 27th, when the legislative body will debate Harper's budget plan that is fiercely opposed by the United Opposition parties, the Liberals, the New Democratic Party, and Bloc Québécois. The Canadian Governor General is the Queen of England's representative in Canada. Dismissing Parliament was the best option for Harper, who could have been forced out of office if he lost a vote of confidence in the body where the opposition controls the majority of seats. On December 1st, the opposition parties offered to form a new government, but the Governor General rejected their request. Outrage against Harper was fueled in recent weeks by the Conservatives' new budget plan that would have repealed the right of federal workers to strike, slashed programs for pay equity, and abolished public financing for political parties. The Liberal leader, Stefan Dion, is stepping down after disappointing the party faithful by losing parliamentary seats in Canada's October 14th election. He is expected to be replaced by the head of the Liberals' moderate wing, Michael Ignatieff, a former Harvard University professor-turned-politician who backed George Bush's war in Iraq. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
With the U.S. economy officially in recession for the past year, the severe financial meltdown and 533,000 jobs lost in November, the precarious condition of the U.S. auto industry is now the subject of debate in the U.S. Congress. House and Senate leaders are working with President Bush to craft a bailout plan that could provide $15 billion in bridge loans to ensure Chrysler and General Motors will survive until a new president and federal legislators are sworn into office in January. The rescue plan being negotiated would name a government overseer appointed by President Bush to set guidelines for restructuring the two companies with the power to revoke the loans if the automakers fail to make the changes necessary to become viable. The White House was seeking to empower what is being called a car czar to force the companies into bankruptcy if they didn't follow a government path to solvency. Proposed conditions on the loan included limits on executive pay, a prohibition on paying out dividends, a requirement that the government share in future profits, and assurances that taxpayers are paid back before any other shareholders. President of the United Auto Workers Union, Ron Gettelfinger, has said if union members were asked to make additional concessions, then his members should be given an equity stake in the company. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Weissman, editor of Multinational Monitor, who assesses the major issues for the U.S. economy linked to the fate of the auto industry.
Well, the first thing is that it's good that they're going to do something. I think there was a lot of reckless talk in Washington over the last couple of weeks about letting the companies go into bankruptcy. I think that would be a very serious mistake and a real disaster for the economy, focused especially in the industrial Midwest, but really amplified all over the country with even severe consequences for the financial system, trade deficit, all kinds of really horrible stuff if they don't take action. So it's good that they're doing something. A second thing is that the $15 billion is not going to be enough. So what they're doing now will be a prelude, almost for sure, to more funding, which means there'll be more opportunity to exert proper controls. And the third thing is what they're proposing includes some positive measures for public control over how the industry operates. But I'm worried about the overemphasis on viability, which is measured in really as soon as possible in market terms, and insufficient attention to environmental sustainability to transform the industry from its old business model of relying on big cars with low gas mileage to invest in transformative technologies that will give us a sustainable transportation system.
Robert, what about the call for more givebacks, more concessions from the United Auto Workers, and the constant drumbeat, especially from right-wing talk show hosts as well as conservative commentators who basically attack the UAW members for making too much money, quote-unquote, and that somehow they have to have their sales trimmed? When you compare it to the lack of scrutiny and calls for cutbacks in terms of these just obscene executive salaries in the financial industry, it just doesn't seem to match up.
Well, that's exactly right. There's one other notable difference, which is that the auto workers' wages are not a significant contributing factor to the cost of a car. The manufacturing wages are less than 10%, about 8.5% of the cost of making a car. So if the UAW members were to donate their labor, it would still not solve the problem for the U.S. car companies. It's also not the case that the U.S. workers make a lot more than the Japanese makers. They make roughly the same. The Japanese companies, with their factories in the United States, have maintained a really strong anti-union stance, but the way they've been able to keep unions out is to maintain wages that are roughly equal with those in the UAW plants. And even in some years, it's actually turned out that Honda and Toyota workers have made more than UAW workers because they've had a different profit-sharing arrangement, and the companies have been more profitable. The only significant difference by way of cost is health care, with UAW workers getting a better health insurance plan. But the big one is what people are calling the legacy cost, the health care cost for retirees. That is a significant cost for GM and Ford. But it's just not the case that there's some major difference in what today's workers are getting at the unionized American plants versus the Japanese plants. All these calls for givebacks ignores that there's been steady drip, drip, drip of givebacks by the United Auto Workers over the last 25 years, and dramatic givebacks in the 2007 contract, where they actually have agreed to slash starting wages for many new jobs at GM and Ford and Chrysler, to half of the current salary structure. So new jobs, many of the new jobs at GM, Ford, and Chrysler, apart from anything new that's going to happen, will start at $14 an hour. So the manufacturing, you know, in an auto plant is going to cease to be a real way into the middle class, a real step forward for at least income security for people. We're seeing these auto worker wages being driven down to Walmart levels. It's exactly what we should not be doing.
Robert, in your article, Nationalize GM, or at least think about it, you talk about the benefits of possibly nationalizing GM or the other automakers. Tell us a little bit about how viable you think that is as an option right now. I mean, we're talking about the $15 billion bridge loan with more loans to come likely in the next Congress. But tell us about your theory about nationalization.
Well, there's one sense in which it's very viable, which is that GM is available for very little money compared to the amounts of money that are being talked about for aid. So I haven't looked where GM ended up today, their stock price. But last week, the company could be had purchased outright for $3 billion, much smaller than the amount of money they're saying they need to get through the next quarter or even the rest of this year. So in terms of the overall amount of money that's being put on the table, you could just buy the company outright for $3 billion and then have total control and not have to negotiate with management and monitor management to see if it's respecting the plans and the objectives that have been agreed to. There are for sure a lot of complications with the government operating an auto company, and it may or may not be a good idea, but I think what is a good idea and what will be vital is for the government to exert control commensurate with the investment that it's going to make in the companies. So if the investment is going to be on a large scale, in whatever form it is, loans or stock purchases or whatever it's called, and the government has to say, we are going to make sure you do things that serve the public interest because we're doing this to advance public objectives, not to advance the narrow objectives of General Motors. And that may mean, and this is, I think, something people in Congress are not coming to terms with right now, that may mean actually doing things that sacrifice some short-term profits. You know, with the price of gas so low right now, I don't think it's going to stay there, but it is so, it's that low right now, the market signal is not to invest in fuel efficiency and undertake long-term investments in transformative technologies. They have to be told they must do that. It's not a discretionary decision for them. That is quid pro quo for getting the government money.
That was Robert Weissman, editor of Multinational Monitor. Read his article, Nationalize GM, or at least think about it, online at multinationalmonitor.org/editorsblog. In early December, members of the Israeli army, known as the Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, forcibly removed a group of radical right-wing Israeli settlers from a building they were occupying in the West Bank city of Hebron, following violent attacks by the settlers on both the IDF and on Palestinian civilians. About 600 settlers living under the protection of the Israeli army reside in the middle of Hebron, a Palestinian city of 130,000. This is one incident among several that have recently caused some Middle East watchers to conclude that relations between Israelis and Palestinians are deteriorating even below their formerly abysmal level. This week, outgoing President Ehud Olmert described the settlers' treatment of Palestinians as a pogrom, a word used historically to describe organized violence against Jews. The situation is extremely volatile, as Israelis will soon be holding national elections, which the far-right Likud Party candidate, former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, is favored to win. The U.S., Israel's strongest and most uncritical supporter, will also inaugurate a new president in January. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Hagit Ofron, the director of the Settlement Watch Project of Peace Now. She keeps track of developments among the 276,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank and 180,000 living in Palestinian East Jerusalem. She explains what happened in the Hebron conflict and the possible ramifications.
A group of settlers broke in the building more than a year and a half ago by force, and only then did they ask a permit to go in. And when they were denied to have this permit, they started a list of petitions to all the courts they can in order to force the government to let them stay in this building. But all of it failed, and 2 weeks ago there was a decision by the Supreme Court saying that they should leave the house in 3 days and that the government has the right to evacuate them after those 3 days. Of course, they were not leaving, and it actually made many, many youngsters in settlers to come to the place in order to protect it from evacuation when they had rumors where the IDF is about to evacuate them. They started to attack mainly the Palestinians around. And I think that violence that took place by the settlers against Palestinians and also against security forces of Israel made our Minister of Defense, Ehud Barak, to decide to kick them out of the house because of the severe violence that took place.
Hagit Ofran, and based on what you just said, it sounds like the aggressive removal of settlers in this case is more of an anomaly than the start of a new Israeli policy. Does it mean anything, do you think?
I think it might have meaning. The IDF did not do anything until today. I think what happened, what made the change, was the fact that the settlers started to attack the IDF itself. And this is something really hard for Israeli public, because the army is everybody. And when there is a group that is fighting against the army, and in some cases violently, people say, why do I send my child to protect those horrible people that attacks him? Because the soldier is there to protect the settlers, and now he's being attacked. So this is like a red line that was crossed by the settlers in the last few months. And I think that made, a slight change in the IDF attitude to the settlers. However, it's very, very far away from law enforcement or taking care of all the violations that are going on in the West Bank by settlers.
So there's been continuous settlement in the West Bank for all these years and stepped up in recent years. Where does that stand now?
Yes, unfortunately, despite all the political process that has been going in the Annapolis summit last year, we see that the construction is still going on almost everywhere in the West Bank. Some of it is done illegally, unofficially, without any permits by the government, but without any reaction or any tries to enforce the law. In some places, it is initiated by the government, especially in those places where the government thinks that in the future agreement it will be swapped by equivalent land to the Palestinians. I mean, that Israel might annex those settlements that are closer to the Green Line, that are most populated, and in return will give land from the lands of Israel to the Palestinian state to be. So they take it for granted that we can build in those places as if there was already an agreement. And we, in Peace Now, we think that one of the biggest obstacles today facing the Israeli chances to get to peace is the settlement activity.
Opinion seems to be changing slowly in the U.S., away from uncritical support for the Israeli government to at least some skepticism about its role, and especially regarding the occupation. How important do you think this change might be for the Israelis and Palestinians being able to reach some kind of resolution?
It could be conducive to an agreement. I think that the lack of criticism by the United States in the last at least 8 years made it possible for Israel to do the most horrible things for the Israeli interest. That means, I always say, if you're a good friend of mine, don't let me drive while I'm drunk. What the U.S. did in general was letting us drive while we're drunk, and we should have been more criticized and not letting us destroy our own partner, the only side in the Palestinians that we can build on in terms of building some kind of an agreement and stop the bloodshed. But in the last 8 years, we were in an enterprise to prove that all the Palestinians are the same and that all of them want to kill us and that we destroyed our own partner. And I think it was pretty much supported by the last administration and maybe the public opinion also in the United States.
That was Hagit Ofran of Peace Now Settlement Watch Project. Contact Americans for Peace Now at area code 202-728-1893 or visit the group's Israeli website at peacenow.org.il. Barack Obama campaigned for the presidency with a pledge to close the U.S. detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, end the military commission proceedings of prisoners there, and abolish the Bush administration's authorization for torture and abusive treatment of American-held detainees. In a December 2007 newspaper interview, Obama said, quote, "As president, I will abide by statutory prohibitions and have the Army Field Manual govern interrogation techniques for all United States government personnel and contractors." Dozens, if not hundreds, of those being held at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, Guantanamo Bay, U.S. bases in Afghanistan, and the unidentified locations of CIA secret prisons have been subjected to brutal interrogations. U.S. soldiers and former detainees have come forward to talk about the stress positions, sexual humiliation, isolation, sleep deprivation, exposure to heat and cold, use of dogs for intimidation, and waterboarding that were employed against terrorist suspects and others. An unknown number of prisoners have died after being abused in U.S. custody. Human rights advocates have urged Obama to appoint an independent prosecutor to initiate a criminal investigation of former Bush administration officials who have authorized torture. While many support the president-elect's stated position on torture, conservative commentators and some in Congress would like to maintain a policy that prohibits the U.S. Armed Forces from engaging in abusive interrogation methods banned by the U.S. Army Field Manual, but allow the CIA to go outside the manual's guidelines. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Christopher Anders, senior legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union, who explains why abolition of government-authorized torture must be a top priority for President-elect Obama's administration.
For those people in the administration who authorized and ordered the use of torture and abuse, there should be a criminal investigation. And there's certainly enough already out there in the public record to support a criminal investigation. Now, whether a prosecutor would find enough to make out a criminal case against anyone, and whether all the evidence is there to prove the case, is something that investigators and the Justice Department would have to determine. But certainly, we live in a country where no one should be above the law. The same law that applies to privates and sergeants at Abu Ghraib, who many are now serving prison terms for their role, apply to the people at the top, too. So, you know, we have one law that applies to everyone, and there should be no one who is immune from either criminal investigations or criminal prosecution simply because they have a nice office in Washington and are not, you know, a 18 or 20-year-old serving at the bottom of the food chain there.
How confident are you that President Obama, when he takes power, will immediately close Guantanamo and other secret CIA prisons that may be still operating around the world?
Well, we're pretty confident that he's going to do it. Now, it's we've built an entire campaign. If you go to ACLU.org, you can get lots of information about it. We built an entire campaign around what we're calling our day one issue. And the interesting thing is that all of those things can be done by executive order. President-elect Obama does not have to wait for Congress to pass anything in order to change all those policies, because all those policies were put in place by executive action, by President Bush's own actions. So anything that President Bush did by his own power can be undone by the next president, by President Obama. So that's one of the things that we're looking for. Now, with shutting down Guantanamo, obviously it's going to take a certain amount of transition time to do that. There are about 250 detainees left at Guantanamo. The vast majority of those would have to be and would be repatriated back to their home countries or to other countries that do not engage in torture or abuse. And then the remaining ones, we believe, should end up being charged and tried in federal criminal civilian courts, rather than in front of these kangaroo courts known as military commissions.
Now, in another area, some members of Congress, as the ACLU has said, may be moving toward a compromise on abolishing U.S. government authorization of torture, such as waterboarding and other abusive interrogation methods. You want to tell us a little bit about what you're hearing in terms of the issue of compromise on torture?
Yeah, and I think this may be an issue that seems to be clearing up a little bit, but I think it also is an area where we all have to be on guard. I think there were a couple of comments made by some important members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, particularly Senator Feinstein, Dianne Feinstein, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, that were disturbing in that, as they were quoted in the New York Times, it looked as if they were backing away from their commitment to applying the Army Field Manual on interrogations, which is maybe not the world's best standard, but a very good one on what can and cannot be done during interrogations. And what they have each clarified since that initial report, that they remain committed to applying that standard to all government agencies, specifically to the CIA. But it is one of the things that we really have to be all on watch for, is that there is a temptation when you're in Congress and your party is in power, your party's in the White House, to not put a lot of restraints on the White House. One of the things that we saw, you know, years ago was that when Bill Clinton was president, a lot of the Republicans who were controlling Congress at that time were very diligent about not giving the president expanded powers in terms of, you know, wiretapping and eavesdropping and things like that, because they had concerns about Janet Reno having that power. But as soon as their person, George Bush, got in power, a lot of those same Republicans started leading the charge for vast new powers to be giving over to the Justice Department for eavesdropping, wiretapping, and other things. And one of the things that we want to make sure, as Democrats control now two branches, will soon control two branches of the government, that we don't have that same dynamic at work, and that Congress still has to remain the watchdog, and Congress still has to remain a part of the government that that remains a check on the executive, even if they're both controlled by the same party.
That was Christopher Anders, Senior Legislative Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. Contact the group at area code 202-457-0800 or visit their website at aclu.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.